Which third are you in? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, Barry, it's great to be back with you here in the studio. Gosh, this is the first time in about 3 weeks we've been able to get together to actually cut a program.
Well, that's because we had a little interruption here in the last couple of weeks called a midterm election.
Yeah,
that was taking a little bit of time out of everybody's schedule.
That definitely can interrupt a lot of things.
Right. Well, it did for about a third of the population. As a matter of fact, Chuck, looking at analysis now that we're a little bit less than 2 weeks beyond the election of 2014, it's clear that the winners in this election were people who chose not to vote. And they might just be the biggest losers, too, depending on how you look at it. But this election, especially in Ohio, and again, this is not what you would call an off-term election. Those are usually the odd years.
Right.
This was not a presidential election year because those are only every four, but this was in the midterm, and that's usually when we have all of our statewide offices. Chuck, according to most reports, this was one of the most historically low voter turnouts for a general election, non-off-year general election, that we've ever had in this state. As a matter of fact, it looked like, if you just look at raw numbers, that a lot of people voted. You know, you got vote totals for various candidates, 1.6 million, 1.3 million, you know, 800,000 if you haven't been on the Democratic side of the ticket.
Yeah, well.
As the Republicans swept just about everything in the
right
state, and by and large nationally, too. But what really was evident, Charles, was that the fact that there were many people who just didn't bother to come out to vote. Now, that's not horribly surprising in an off-year election when there's usually just local ballot names and,
all right,
and local
city
ballot
council,
issues,
city council issues,
or, you know,
that kind of
dog
thing,
catcher,
yeah,
that kind of stuff. But it's a little odd for a general election because even primaries sometimes have low voter turnouts, although usually they're a little bit higher because you get partisans who really come out during primaries wanting one candidate or the other to be the nominee. But the ballot was set. Everybody knew who the candidates were going to be. And we still had one of the most historically low turnouts in Ohio election history. Now, this time around, that favored the Republicans who happened to be on the wave of momentum against all things Obama and all things Democratic Party. And I think they were helped in a great deal here in the state of Ohio by the lackluster showing and missteps and misadventures of what we called the wreck of the Edward Fitzgerald.
Yes.
who honestly wasn't alone in pulling the entire Democratic ticket down to defeat, except for a small handful of races. There were no surprises. No Democrat that I know of took a Republican seat unexpectedly, but there was one Republican who took a Democratic seat somewhat,
yes,
unexpectedly.
Well,
and it wasn't just,
I'd say very unexpectedly.
Very unexpectedly to everybody, including this Democrat incumbent office holder who also happened to be the chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party, Chris Redfern, who lost his reelection to his own House seat in Port Clinton. Now, for those of you who follow politics, if you got a D behind your name and you're running in that particular seat, it's a fairly good shoe-in. You're going to win election. But the Democratic Party was so disillusioned and so dissatisfied with their own chief, Chris Redfern, that Democrats came out, either stayed home in so big enough droves that the Republican, guy by the name of Ralph Krauss, ended up taking that seat from Chris Redfern. Now, I know our friends in the Tea Party movement are you know, making a lot about that issue, and that's fine. You got, go ahead and count a little coup there. But just remember one thing, though, folks. I'm going to prognosticate it right now. I believe that that's a one-term incumbent there, because that seat is historically Democratic, And I'm not sure that Mr. Krause, now maybe he will surprise me and everybody else and be a fantastic rep, and the people of the district will just fall in love with him and he'll hold that seat for four cycles. I just don't see it happening. That was more of a message to the Democratic Party by their own partisans than it was a change in the electorate to conservative Republicanism. You know?
Well, I have to look at this election when I look at what we're going to talk about, and that's partly, and that's the actual turnout. I have to wonder, you know, when this many people fail to come out on a midterm with so many things at stake, the question is why? And what that really does is that leaves the election in the hands of, for instance, when I look at John Kasich, you and I thought when we first looked at it that John Kasich was going to pull a lot of undervotes.
And he did pull some, because
yes,
if you looked at his numbers in his reelection and this year versus the numbers that he picked up when he ran against Ted Strickland four
right.
years ago, it's clear that there was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think it was 300,000 to 400,000 who didn't vote the top of the ticket this
right.
cycle. But again, the lack of turnout could have been a factor in that as well.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. My idea is that a lot of the people that basically weren't going to vote for the top of the ticket just didn't come.
Didn't vote at all. And I think that does play out in looking at these numbers of the turnout numbers. Now, folks, the point is that we have about 11 million citizens in the state of Ohio, 11 million warm bodies. Probably a good 80% of those are people who are of voting age. And the way it breaks down in Ohio is we have roughly 1.2 million to 1.3 million registered Democrats. We have somewhere in the 1 million to 1.1 million range registered Republicans. And then there's about 4.8 to 5.4 million nonpartisan registered voters. In other words, we have about 7 of the 11 million people in the state of Ohio are registered to vote. But we had turnout numbers. If you just looked at the top of the ticket, total turnout, somewhere in the 2.7 million range. Now, you figure that's about 37 to 38% mm-hmm. of the actual registered voters bothered to show up. During what, you're right, Chuck, and I think you characterized this correctly, was a very high-stakes midterm election. The control of the United States Senate was on the line. Now, granted, not in Ohio, because neither one of our U.S. senators were up for election.
Right.
All of our statewide offices were on the line. Well, I guess you could say on the line, although it was fairly clear from about August forward that there was only one race that even was remotely considered competitive anymore, and that was the Ohio Treasurer's race between Josh Mandel and Connie Pillich, who Mandel did such a great job in that race, he actually even won Pillich's home county. So people in her own home county didn't vote. Well, Ed Fitzgerald had the same problem in Cleveland. And that was what surprised me.
Yes.
John Kasich took Cuyahoga County in this election. That's usually unheard of for a Republican candidate. Usually you try to lose by less than 200,000 votes in Cuyahoga County. You try to break even in Franklin County, and then you try to pick up the 200,000 votes in Hamilton County, the 3C highway. That's the historic math that
right.
we've used in state elections. If a Republican is going to win, he has to lose by less than 200,000 votes in Cuyahoga County, which has been a Democratic bastion for decades. You know, granted, I know George Voinovich being a former mayor there doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Well, and being a rhino.
Well, yeah. Well, see, and now I think you're scratching the surface on maybe why that changed around. Now, the governor had spent an awful lot of time and taxpayer resources making sure that Cleveland was amenable to him. Now, Grant, everybody knows 2 years ago you had the Senate Bill 5 situation, which got most of the unions mad at Governor Kasich and the Republicans. Well, in the last 2 years, the governor spent an awful lot of time in Cleveland. There have been a number of transportation projects that have gone on in Cleveland. There has been an awful lot of support that's been going up there for various social service issues. And the governor, kind of in a somewhat unprecedented fashion, personally campaigned for the last Cleveland public school levy. So he threw his weight behind passage of a school levy. What that did was, I think it mollified or satisfied the teachers unions and the other, some of the other unions in the, in Cuyahoga County, to the point where, and granted, maybe I'm underselling the Cuyahoga County Republican Party's turnout machine, but even so, and I think that with Ed Fitzgerald living and being the former county executive of Cuyahoga County, perhaps maybe the people up there were just so dissatisfied with him and so, shall we say, not dissatisfied with John Kasich that he pulled off something that's rare, and that's a Republican winning Cuyahoga County and winning it fairly handily.
Well, let me take you in the Wayback Machine for a minute. Yeah. My senior year in high school, I'm 57 years old, so you can do the math. This was, I think, 1974.
Do I have to do the Common Core version of this math?
Yeah. We'll do that topic at some other time.
Exactly.
In 1974, the gubernatorial was John Gilligan versus Rhodes.
Yeah, Jim Rhodes.
Jim Rhodes. And Jim Rhodes took Cuyahoga County.
Yes, he did.
And he took it handily. And everybody kind of said, what happened there? Well, what happened there was everybody was sick and tired of John Gilligan. And yes. the income tax that he was so proud of getting passed, it was a complete repudiation of the income tax. Guess what, folks? We still have the income tax. 40 years later, well, actually, when was that? 72?
72, yes.
So for now 42 going on 43 years later, we still have the income tax. But Jim Rhodes was elected as a repudiation of John Gilligan.
Yes, he was. Now it's my understanding from listening to post-election discussions, they have a thing called Impact Ohio where, you know, the governor and the legislative leadership talk with basically the lobbyists. Now, I'm catching this secondhand because it's a yawner. Even though I'm a lobbyist, I don't go to that because nothing they say there is actually going to be, you know, made in stone until a budget's passed in the next summer. But what they're talking about was, I think the vision casting, at least they hope us to see this, is the repeal of the Ohio income tax over time. That they're looking at as step downs, and that's part of the argument that the governor is going to be making for increasing the taxes on fracking, for increasing other taxes, including taxes on cigarettes, things of that nature. It's a repeal and replace kind of scenario, Charles.
Yeah.
And we all know where that gets to.
Yeah. That ends up basically that you end up with both taxes.
You end up with both taxes. And so some of the tax reductions that were passed in the last budget for small businesses supposedly are going to be then, you know, added on to with backing off of other taxes with supposedly a goal. And again, I'm going to, you know, give due deference here that the governor really does intend to repeal Ohio's income tax. That's great. But it's one of those things, Charles, and I hate being a doubting Thomas, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Yes.
You know, so we'll see what happens there. But based upon those type of considerations, the governor won Ed Fitzgerald's home county and ended up winning by basically, I think it was almost a 2-1 margin against Ed Fitzgerald, who had done himself no favors since the beginning of his campaign with missteps and miscalculations the entire way.
Well, he had another disadvantage in that the only place where his name was recognized was in Cuyahoga County.
That's right. Very, very few people, including Democrats, even knew who this person was. As much as I hate yard signs, being a political animal, I hate yard signs.
I know you always tell your candidates don't waste your money on yard signs.
And some people look at me like I've grown a third eye in the middle of my forehead for saying that. But I did look at it as one barometer. I may have seen 5 Ed Fitzgerald yard signs throughout the state.
You could have come to Westerville and seen 3 of them because I know where
I might have seen 1 or 2 of them here. That's for sure. But you know how much I travel all over the state of Ohio on a regular basis.
They weren't out there.
The lack of support for this particular candidate was palpable in the state of Ohio. And honestly, really, that's, I think it was a big factor with the Republicans being able to sweep everything in the state from the top to the bottom. I mean, we now have an Ohio House that has the largest majority they've had in 60 years. You know, they now are sitting at 65 members. They only need like two more members, and they'll have like basically a supermajority veto-proof lockbox where they don't have to worry about anything from anybody in order to get what they want. The Republican Senate stayed at 23 members. They thought they were going to pick up one Democrat seat, and they thought they might lose a Republican, but neither one of those transpired, so everything stayed the same. You know, only the names are changed. The seats are all still there. The governor's reelected, all the statewides, the Secretary of State, the Auditor, the Treasurer, the Attorney General, everybody stayed put. Are the two Republicans who were up for the Ohio Supreme Court for reelection. Both got back in fairly easily.
Yeah, fairly easily.
There were really no surprises. All the congressional races pretty much stayed with the incumbents. There weren't any big shakeups or major, you know, flips in Ohio's demographic. Now, we did on the national level have a significant flip in the demographic, where the House Republicans now have one of their largest majorities they've had since, I believe it was since the New Deal.
It's
been huge. You know, so John Boehner's sitting on probably the second largest margin in modern history for Republicans in Congress. And Mitch McConnell, who will be the incoming Senate majority leader, is now sitting there looking at a 52 seats, possibly 53 or 54, depending on how two runoffs go.
Yeah, there's that Alaska seat that basically isn't decided yet,
right,
because Begich won't give in because all the votes haven't been counted. Because
right,
in Alaska, folks, there are still people out in the hinterlands, and they still count the ballots by hand. So
yep,
not all the votes are counted up there.
Right, so that one's in question. And then there's a runoff election in Louisiana. That's going to happen beginning of next month to see if Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu keeps her seat or not. And the likelihood is that the Democrats are probably going to abandon her in Louisiana in order to be able to have a senator who is going to be able to do something for the state of Louisiana in the upcoming term.
Okay, but don't count Mary Landrieu out, and I'll tell you why.
Well, no, I get that.
She is a master at this. In runoffs, she's done this before. She did it in 2002. She ran away from the party, and she told the party to stay out. In fact, she said no money, no ads,
right,
nothing. And she won. She won that race.
Yeah, but the damage may have already been done before this.
True.
With her, and so she may not have the opportunity of having that kind of luxury of disassociating herself from the Obama administration. Now, Chuck, it was clear to most people before this election that we were looking at a tidal wave. Now, I remember I talked to you about this on election night. I'm watching one of the cable news channels, and they had a panel on there, and they had a couple of conservatives, and they had Juan Williams, who's a hardcore liberal, and they were asking him about this tidal wave, and he was bending over backwards to deny that there was any kind of a Republican tidal wave happening
yeah,
at all. This was just a small ripple, minor course correction. There wasn't really anything of any historic significance about that night, according to Juan Williams. And even one of his own other liberal commentators looked at him and said, "You must be kidding, right?"
Yeah. Well, look, this is like Karl Rove, if you recall, in 2012, standing there screaming with his whiteboard, "Just wait till all the votes are counted. I'm telling you, it's going to come in for Romney." And the results kept coming in, and he's like, "No, no, 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 wait till the real results get in." And it's sort of like, Karl, he's going down. There's just really nothing you can do about it. You know, wishful thinking only gets you so far.
Yeah.
This reminds me of the ad that used to be on TV, and I can't remember what it was before, but a guy's looking through a telescope, and he sees this big flaming mass coming at him, and this thing is, like, getting closer and closer and closer, and he's like, ah! He screams, and it drops at his feet, and it's about the size of a peanut, and then it's... So that's kind of what happened to Juan Williams.
It's all in your perspective. Yeah. And his perspective was kind of thrown off. Well, he wasn't alone. I mean, there's another outlet, the old gray lady, the New York Times.
The New York Times, yeah.
Basically bent over backwards by running an article in their newspaper from a Duke University professor, basically begging that we cancel the midterm elections. In other words, they don't think it's quite, you know, a worth the time of the electorate to come out during a midterm and vote for congressmen every 2 years. We should ought to just make them a four-year term. And then because, well, you know, now that the Senate is popularly elected, too, we could spread them out as well. And so that way, about once every 4 to 6 years, everybody can come vote.
Right.
Now we do the math on that, and you figure if you do this every 6 years, we're extending the term of the president, too.
Yes.
Which I think is really ultimately what this professor at Duke University by the name of David Shanzer was really getting at, and that was, let's let Barack Obama have more time.
Well, okay, here's the problem, and here's how if you want to play show him the devil, you can say, well, oh, so you want us to adopt the Confederate Constitution method of picking the president because he got 1 6-year term. Is that what you're talking about? No, not the Confederate Constitution. I'll guarantee you. But that's what it said.
Right.
The president got 1 6-year term.
Well, here's what they said in their article in the New York Times, and I'm actually reading this off of nationalreview.com, who did a great job of, like, filleting the New York Times and this professor. But this was the actual quote from the Times article. It says, "The main impact of the midterm election in the modern era has been to weaken the president." Yeah, that's what midterms are all about, is a referendum on whether or not the president has done a good job in pushing his policies.
That's not really what it was for. this professor's entire basically underlying foundational philosophy about how government is supposed to work is completely wrong. Yes, it turns out to be a referendum on presidential power, but that's because the presidents have more than their allotted amount of constitutional power.
Because they've taken more than they should have.
Right.
And I think he's right in this other paragraph. He says, "The realities of the modern election cycle are that we spend almost 2 years, and now it's more than 2 years,
right,
selecting a president with a well-developed agenda." Okay, I'm not sure which president he's talking about, but it's not the current one.
Yes.
"But then, less than 2 years after the inauguration, the midterm election cripples that same president's ability to advance that agenda." Actually, Chuck, no, it's not. That referendum is on the agenda itself. Is that agenda good for the American public? And if it is, then they will vote the supporters of that agenda back into office. If it is not, and you will see what we saw in Tuesday's midterm, a changing of the guard.
Well, let's take a look at what happens during presidential campaigns. The presidents normally couch their agenda. A, there are big parts of it they don't tell you about because they know they're unpopular. And B, they couch them in terms that's all positive and there's no negatives. So what happens at the 2 year, at the midterm, everybody takes a look. They've had 2 years to digest what it actually looks like when it passes through the congressional digestive tract, if you will. And either they like it or they really don't like it, or they hate it, or because you'll get midterm elections where, yeah, there's some dissatisfaction, but for the most part, people will take it. No, and then you get midterms like we just had where everybody says, get rid of it.
Yeah.
Give me a bottle of KO Pectate because it's time to broom this out of the
body politic.
Out of the body politic. And the fact is, that's what you saw here. Now, what he's basically saying is, oh, no, the president, being the president, should have all this time, all the time he needs to fully develop his agenda, even if it might wreck everything, which is one of the reasons why a lot of people repudiate presidential agendas at the midterm. We've been hearing people saying, well, we may not make it to the next election. I mean, we hear that every year. If we don't recover things in the next 2 years, then I think it's all over. We've heard it over and over and over again. I've been hearing it for 40 years or more. And guess what? We keep chugging along. Now,
that's it.
Do things get any better from time to time? They lighten up a little bit.
Sometimes, yes.
But for the most part, it's a downhill slide. But the real question is, do you want a downhill slide 10-degree slope, or do you want to do it on an 80-degree slope? And right now people are saying 10% is much better. We'll take 10, not 80.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And everybody knows that we've been doing the 80-degree thing. Now, when the President of the United States comes out and says, well, for all those folks out there who didn't come out and vote, I heard you. In other words, clearly you're with me. No, clearly if they were with you, they would have reelected your team.
Well, and that gets us to another little piece there. And that's the reason why I the teaser up front was, which third are you in?
Yeah.
And if you remember back during the War for Independence, everybody thinks that that was like this major thing and everybody was involved. But really, when you start looking historically, you'll find that about a third of the population were liberty-minded and were with the Patriots and with the Founding Fathers group. A third were British loyalists with the Tories, and the other third were totally apathetic and didn't care just as long as things kept going along and they could go and get their mercantiles and get their commerce and have their, you know, worship and do that thing. Just, I don't care who's in government, leave me alone.
Well, their argument, the guys in the middle, their argument was, can't we all just get along?
Right, exactly. And the answer is no.
Yes, the answer was no.
The historic and still current answer is no. But today, we don't have a third, a third, and a third. At least not according to Barack Obama, who, in a speech that he gave just last week after the election, this was like, the day after the election, said, basically that for the one-third of the voters who came out to vote, let me assure you that we understand what you're saying. And then he kept going. He said, and for the two-thirds who didn't come out to vote, let me assure you that I hear you loud and clear. In other words, what he was trying to do was trying to say that those two-thirds were somehow disenfranchised and weren't able to come out and support his agenda because there wasn't the opportunity to do so in some fashion or other. What he's trying to say is, I'm going to continue to doing just what I'm going to do, and I'm going to use this phantom two-thirds of the non-voting electorate as my rationale for the popularity of my proposals, not looking at the one-third who came out and totally repudiated my proposals.
Well, it's a laughable thing, but this will be the meme. Now, if you really want to get a kind of a good laugh and you can stand it, go over to MSNBC and watch how they're going to spend the next 2 years until 2016.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm already seeing it. In fact, the day after election, I ran into an article that based on Yahoo, but it was reprinted from someplace like the Slate or Salon, maybe. But what it said was that Hillary Clinton was the real winner of the 2014 midterms. And, of course, Rand Paul came out the same day with an article that said, no, the biggest loser was Hillary. And basically the guy said who said she was a winner basically said because it puts her in the driver's seat for the 2016 presidential election. But Rand Paul came out and said every candidate save one that she campaigned for and came out big for lost.
Yeah. Absolutely, every last one of them. I was going to say, if it puts her in the driver's seat, it puts her in a seat of a car that has no steering wheel, no brakes, and someone has tied a cinder block to the gas pedal and pointed it to the cliff.
Well, it was going to go over. I mean, I've been telling people all along, and you and I have used this metaphor all the time, and it drives the rhinos nuts. It's they'll tell you, well, you need to vote for this party's candidate versus this party's candidate. And I always say, well, look, what's the difference between the two candidates? This guy's driving the car over the cliff at 25 and this guy's doing it at 80.
Right.
Well, yeah, if 25 is preferable, but you're still going to, it's still a 500-foot fall. You're all going to die, whether you're going 25 or 80. And sometimes 80 is more fun, at least until you hit the guardrail. So don't give me this stuff about how so-and-so was better than so-and-so. No, they're just driving the car at a different speed. They're not, but they're going in the same direction. I'd rather be the guy standing at the curve at the top going, slow down, stop, don't drive over. You're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, we keep doing this, and people keep saying, well, but we've got to vote for the lesser of two evils.
I would always counter back that then you're still voting
you're
for
still
evil,
voting for
and
evil.
So therefore you're making your decision. And that's fine. And honestly, though, you know, I'll just be quite frank about it. There were some races I voted, but there were some races I didn't pick a candidate because not choosing is still making a choice.
Yes.
An undervote is still a vote. You know, my friend, an undervote is still a vote, ladies and gentlemen. And if I looked at those races and I looked at the list of candidates there and I didn't feel that any of them measured up, not to just my standard, but to a biblical standard or to a constitutional standard, then why would I hand my franchise to one of those individuals? It makes no sense from any sort of analysis. Now, granted, some people will say, "Oh, well, you're just being a perfectionist." No, I know there was
We're
only
fully
one.
Aware
there
that
was only one perfect person, and we know what they did to him.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to say is, until we, as the electorate, who have been given the blessing and the responsibility of choosing those who we will have rule over us, make wiser, better, more logical, and constitutionally faithful choices, we can't sit here and complain about why government's running away, why we have an administration that seems drunk with power and is basically going off on a make-believe mandate to do whatever they feel like. Well, folks, you know, we've only got, it's like we tell our classes at IOTC, look in the mirror. You know, if you don't like what's going on in this government, look in the mirror, because you're the ones to blame.
Yeah.
And yeah, ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about me and Chuck here and you. Let's just be honest about it. It's time for us to stop soft-pedaling this. It's time to stop, you know, worrying about each other's feelings. The future of our country and what we're leaving our kids is far too important. It's reprehensible that we had less than a 40% turnout for a midterm election. It's equally reprehensible that in many races we didn't have a good candidate to vote for. And that's the reason why we had less than a 40% turnout in this midterm election, because a lot of people just understood it didn't make any difference to them. You know, yes, it does make a difference. You know, your vote always makes a difference. But when you say, I've got a franchise and I take it seriously, and I look at a ballot line and every choice on there is distasteful to me, or as Jefferson would say, you know, who wants me to pay for things that I find that I'm in opposition to, that's the basis of tyranny, that all of them are just tyrants in waiting. Folks, you know, we've got to get in and we got to make some changes. And you can't just do that trot not once every 2 years or every 4 years to a ballot box to, quote unquote, do your civic duty. Your civic duty is every day when you train your children up, when you rise up and when you lie down and when you go in the way and when you come back home. And you put God's law, you put his rules, you put his standards in front of you as your benchmark. I'm coining a new phrase, Chuck. Maybe it's not a new phrase. I just haven't seen anybody else coin it, but I'm going to do so today on the program. I'm theolytical.
I like that.
I'm not just theological, and I'm not just political. I'm theolytical.
You realize that's what that's going to get you in the atmosphere of the church. Not the whole thing, but the large sections of the church. That's going to get you labeled. Oh, you're one of
them.
Yeah.
Well, I'm already labeled that in my churches, so that's fine. I don't mind being on Southern Poverty Law Center's watch list. It's okay too. But I'm going to coin that phrase, and I hope it catches on. I'm theolytical. That means I take my theology and my politics seriously. But my theology leads my politics, not the other way around.
Not vice versa, right? And that's a, unfortunately, people don't get that, including a lot of people who are politically active.
Yes.
and big names in the there are really two major categories in the evangelical field regarding the way you deal with politics. One is that you let politics drive your theology.
Yes.
And the other is that you avoid politics altogether and, in fact, just simply abandon everything to the quote-unquote common realm because, after all, the church shouldn't have anything to do with those things. Those are under someone else's control.
Right. Well, what you have on one – it's funny, Chuck, because we always talk about the dichotomies, the liberal-conservative dichotomy.
Right.
Well, if you look at this, being theolytical, on one end of the spectrum, the conservative wing of that is what we call R2K theology. The liberal wing of that is what we call social justice theory, okay? You know, one end is, okay, the culture is going to do whatever they want to do, and we just have to be okay with it theologically. And the other is, well, we need to have social justice, and we need to have equity and everything else, and that's going to influence how we read the Bible. So that's on the one end of the spectrum. You've got the conservative and the liberals both in fairly similar camps. On the other end of the spectrums, you have theonomy and right. Reconstruction, which is the conservative side of that coin. And then on the liberal side of that coin, you have socialism.
Yeah.
You know, that. So we're looking at a spectrum here. And really, it's kind of funny because I've always said that it's not a line, it's a circle. Because if you think about it, social justice and socialism are all basically both the two sides of the same coin.
Sure.
And that's really...
It's all about using the power of the state to supposedly implement the Christian agenda when, in fact, you have to twist the Christian agenda into social justice.
Right.
You can't read it from the New Testament. And especially in light of the Old Testament, and let's face it, that's a continuous, that's a continuum. And to get there, you have to completely twist everything up and make it look like things are said that aren't said.
Right. So basically, I'm taking on a new label and I'm coining a new phrase. I'm theolytical. I do let my theology drive my politics, which is the reason why most of the time I'm really not extremely excited about the choices we have in front of us for electoral politics.
I can't remember the last time we had a really decent candidate at the higher level.
Mm-hmm.
We've had them locally.
And
it's always great to have those guys, and they almost never win. But does that stop us from supporting them and working for them?
No, of course
not. No, because, I mean, you have there is a duty to see that those kind of candidates, and if you don't understand why, then we'll do this for a plug. Take one of our Institute on the Constitution courses.
Absolutely.
There's one somewhere near you all the time. Right now we're wrapping one up in Sunbury. There's one that just started in Canal Winchester. That's one of our alumni that's teaching that class. So, yes, we do encourage you to go out and teach your own classes, mostly because, you know, people think, well, you guys must make money on this. Not hardly, baby.
We don't take a dime for what we do.
Yeah, it costs us money.
It actually costs us money, but we do it because we love it and because we want people, we want to see those light bulbs come on.
When and
we
they
see,
do.
See that look on people's faces when it all clicks and they realize that, yes, even our entire structure of government was theolytical.
Yes.
It was. It really was. And it still is, except the fact that we have so much repressed that God influence on our culture and on our politics that we think that this is normal. And it's not. We don't live in normal, Chuck. We live in the culture of rebellion. We live in that, if you look at the Old Testament, when there was no judge in Israel, every man did what was right in his own eyes.
Yeah.
We kind of live in that environment.
We live in a judge's period, yes.
Yeah, and really what it's going to take is for God's people, for Christians, to take it seriously. Folks, you got to take your faith seriously.
Well,
and taking your faith seriously doesn't just mean going to church every Sunday, tithing, and maybe funding foreign missions. It includes looking and working in your own community where God has planted you to increase the harvest. And the theological is not separated from the experiential. The theological is not separated from your day-to-day affairs in life. It's not separated from who you choose to rule over you, where, how you choose to educate your children, what job you choose to work. All of those things are encompassed under
compartmentalization.
That.
Really is not a good thing.
Well, it never has been. Never will be either.
Think about it, Barry, though. Let me ask you a question. How many times have we had people that almost dropped out in the first three or four weeks of that class because I'm not taking a darn Christianity class. I want to take a Constitution class.
Oh, well, quite a few.
And we tell them, you have to understand this part of it to get the part that comes up in the last 6 weeks.
Right, right. You have to understand the foundations before you understand what the building is. You know, if you know what the foundation is, you can pretty much guess where the building is going to go. But if you don't have any clue of your foundation, then your building is going to be all over the place. Well, yeah.
Wonder where that comes from.
Yeah, it seems somewhat familiar, maybe.
So if the man who builds his house on the sand, oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Chuck, speaking of building houses on sand, okay, this is another area where God bless all of our wonderful friends in the social conservative, pro-life, pro-family movement. Everybody is having a wonderful, warm feeling, not just from the midterm elections, who they think that now everything's going to be sunshine and light now that Mitch McConnell and John Boehner control Congress.
That's not going to work out.
I want to hear how they're talking in about 6 months.
Making a prediction now, not going to work out.
We want to hear how they're saying that in about 6 months from now. But they're excited or giddy almost about a ruling that just came out of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the U.S. circuit which covers Ohio, Kentucky, Michigan, and Tennessee. This particular court issued a ruling late last week in a case that was determining whether or not the people of said states, and it was a combined case. These were cases coming out of Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And these cases were all from same-sex couples who were challenging the states in their Defense of Marriage Acts or their marriage amendments that they were passed by popular vote of the electorate in those said states, and especially in Ohio. 63% of the voting populace came out and supported this particular measure. Well, a three-judge panel, the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, heard the arguments, and issued their ruling last week with Justice Jeffrey Sutton issuing the majority opinion, in which Justice Deb Cook concurred. And then Justice Daughtry, who was the third member of the panel, issued a dissent. Now, before everybody gets too excited about this, you and I had chatted offline when this came out about one of the things that Justice Sutton had said in his majority opinion that kind of raised a few red flags with me. Really what he was saying is, and the decision, the 2-1 decision, was to uphold the constitutionality of those states' marriage amendments. Because the way Justice Sutton, and I'm spitballing it because I don't have the quote right here.
I have it in front of me. Let me read it.
You go ahead and read it, and then we'll analyze it.
Here's the quote. Of all the ways to resolve this question, one option is not available. A poll of the three judges on this panel, or for that matter, all federal judges, about whether gay marriage is a good idea. Our judicial commissions did not come with such a sweeping grant of authority, one that would allow just two of us, to make such a vital policy call for the 32 million citizens who live within the four states of the Sixth Circuit, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee. So, it normally goes with the Constitution. The written charter cements the limitations on government into an unbending bulwark, not a vain alterable whenever alterations occur. Unless and until the people, like contracting parties, choose to change the contract through the agreed-upon mechanisms for doing so. End quote.
Okay. Basically, what Justice Sutton is getting at is the federal courts are not given the authority under the Constitution yet to determine what marriage is. Now, granted, I will say kudos because that is a cogent analysis of understanding your limitations. But the problem is, what it's doing is it's, and you and I talked about this, I believe it's a signal to either Congress or to the American public, hey, it's time we change the Constitution because this is the way it's going. Now, I'm reaffirmed in that thinking, Chuck, and I'll tell you why. Because what you read was a piece a little bit later on in Justice Sutton's opinion. Let me read you how he opens his opinion. And he says, this is a case about change and how best to handle it under the United States Constitution. From the vantage point of 2014, it would now seem the question is not whether American law will allow gay couples to marry. It is when and how that will happen. That would not have seemed likely as recently as a dozen years ago. For better, for worse, or for more of the same, marriage has long been a social institution defined by relationships between men and women. So long defined, the tradition is measured in millennia, not centuries or decades. So widely shared, the tradition until recently had been adopted by all governments and major religions of the world. But things change, sometimes quickly. Since 2003, 19 states and the District of Columbia have expanded the definition of marriage to include gay couples, some through state legislation, some through initiatives of the people, some through state court decisions, and some through the actions of state governors and attorneys general who opted not to appeal adverse court decisions. Nor does this momentum show any sign of slowing. 12 of the 19 states that now recognize gay marriage did so in the last couple of years. On top of that, four federal courts of appeals have compelled several other states to permit same-sex marriages under the 14th Amendment. What remains is a debate about whether to allow the democratic processes begun in the states to continue in the four states of the Sixth Circuit, or to end them now by requiring all states in the circuit to extend the definition of marriage to encompass gay couples. Process and structure matter greatly in American government. Indeed, they may be the most reliable, liberty-assuring guarantees of our system of government, requiring us to take seriously the route the United States Constitution contemplates for making such a fundamental change to such a fundamental social institution.
So basically, amend the Constitution.
This is a call for a constitutional convention to amend the Constitution.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you might be right. Now, let me... That's disingenuous, first of all. None of the states, none of them that have allowed homosexual marriage did so through the referendum process.
Did so through referendum.
Zero.
Well, they would be arguing that Vermont's civil unions was democratic
which
process.
Which was legislative, not referendum.
Not referendum, that's right.
Now, would it possibly pass a referendum in a state like Vermont or Massachusetts? Well, Barry, let's talk about that for a minute. Even if it did, does that mean that Ohio has to recognize those marriages? That's exactly what Article 4 of the Constitution is for.
Right.
Article 4 says that Congress has the authority to set the effect of the full faith and credit of the laws of one state in another. So in other words, if there is a law that's passed in Massachusetts that would adversely affect, in the opinion of Ohio, its strongly held public policy, then Congress has the right to say, you don't have to accept that in Ohio. And that's exactly what they did with a law called DOMA,
right?
The Defense of Marriage Act. Now, in that, it basically said the effect of the full faith and credit clause on, for instance, the Massachusetts law, which was the first. Thank you, Mitt Romney, done by executive action, not by legislative. And don't kid yourself, not by judicial action, because in Massachusetts, the judiciary cannot change an existing law. They can find it unconstitutional, but that does not negate it. So, that being said, Congress passed this law, I think in 1994, Bill Clinton signed it, that basically set that the effect in states that had a strongly held public policy, like Ohio, that the effect of that law is zero. In other words, you can't get married in Massachusetts and come to Ohio and look for a divorce because we don't recognize your marriage. When I say that, a gay marriage, a homosexual marriage.
Right.
Okay. What did the court rule? The court actually ruled recently the Supreme Court, that part of Article 4, now what they did was quote-unquote strike down that part of DOMA that said that that would have no effect. But what they in reality said was that they struck down Article 4. Because Congress had done this legally within the limits of the Constitution. They said, you can't do that. It's a public policy issue. And it's state by state. So what the Supreme Court did was they struck down that part of Article 4 that said Congress can do that. So what they did was they found the Constitution unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we've talked about that in the past.
Yes.
Now, and the way they did it was citing the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was never designed, ever. All you have to do mm-hmm. is read Raulberger's, I believe it's called right. The 14th Amendment, or I can't remember the name of the book now. I have a copy of it here. He talks about the fact that this was never designed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what this judge is, I'm assuming that's Judge Sutton in Judge Sutton's opinion that you read from.
Yeah, it was in the majority opinion from Justice Sutton.
Yes. Yeah. What Sutton basically said was, well, we really shouldn't do it this way. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out a way to get in there. And I think you're correct. Let's have an amendment, and that's never going to pass right. Congress in an amendment, so let's do an Article 5 convention.
Right. Well, basically what he gets to, later on in his discussion, it's on page 18 of the 64-page decision.
Verbosity.
You know, he basically says this whole idea about, in trying to figure out the original meaning of a provision, it is fair to say the line between interpretation and evolution blurs from time to time. That is an occupational hazard for judges when it comes to old or generally worded provisions. And he says, yet that knotty problem does not confront us. Yes, the 14th Amendment is old, and yes, it is generally worded. It says, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Nobody in this case, however, argues that the people who adopted the 14th Amendment understood it to require the states to change the definition of marriage. So he's saying this 14th Amendment argument isn't working. Okay, so he's closed the door there on a 14th Amendment argument. And he talks about tradition reinforcing the point, and he looks at various cases through the courts. You know, that up until 2003, every state defined marriage as a relationship between a man and a woman. And so, you know, he talks about the rational basis review, and he goes through all of these checks, judicial checks, on whether or not this works. And what he comes down to is basically the bottom line is you're just going to have to change the Constitution to get what you want. And we know the culture's going that way. And we know it's inevitable, but it can only be inevitable through this circuit if you change the Constitution to clarify that the 14th Amendment protects the right of gay people to
homosexuals
to have marriage.
They're not gay.
Yeah, you're right.
Homosexuals.
You're right. I'm using his language. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're right. Homosexuals to approximate a marriage. So, you know, this is one of those situations where there's a lot of good in the decision, but ultimately, and because we're now discussing an institution that God created and that God gives authority to and that God defines, and we're handing it off to three people in black robes to make a decision, at least one of them had the humility to say, you know, we really don't have the power to do this under this Constitution. It's going to be up to you. Now, the question is, since we've just had the U.S. Supreme Court deny a hearing on other cases which went the exact opposite direction,
right,
and said that because of the 14th Amendment and other reasons, it is unconstitutional for a state to prohibit homosexuals from having these arrangements. It's going to be interesting to see how and if the court takes this one up, or are they really actually wanting to create the frisson between the states who, through whatever fiat, said, we want homosexuals to have legal standing as couples in our state, and the states who either by their own constitutions or statutes said, no, marriage, we're going to recognize the God-given institution as it is. And the states who, because they happen to be in the wrong circuit, are stuck one way or the other. I mean, I seriously don't see Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, or Kentucky, any of those four states, really as a popular choice saying, yeah, we want homosexuals to marry in our state.
No, it's not going to happen.
It's not going
to
happen.
Despite Mike Coleman's efforts to the contrary.
Right, with the city of Columbus is trying to push. Now, they're hoping to get a repeal of the constitutional amendment on the ballot for 2016.
They're dreaming.
And, well, that's a turnout mechanism for the Democrats the election.
Sure it is.
And after this midterm election, they're going to need everything they can possibly put in the kitchen sink in order to get people out.
Well, I'm not so sure about that because I can already see that the Republicans are going to blow it by the numbers.
Well, yeah.
Every one of the new senatorial candidates who just got elected and threw out incumbents basically campaigned on the idea of repealing Obamacare and stopping amnesty for illegal immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican Party's already making noises. John Boehner's already having meetings with Obama to plan out the strategy to give amnesty. And the whole repeal and replace, which I've referred to as the repeal and replace fetish,
mm-hmm.
because it is a fetish, replace just means that, well, we're eventually going to get with Obamacare, but we're going to do it more slowly rather than requiring it all at once. We're going to go there little by little by little by little.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the replace is. And I can tell you that those of us who have been paying attention have told the guys who want to do the replace thing, take a walk, pal, because it's basically Obamacare lite.
Right. No,
okay.
You're right.
So I can see basically a disaffection in 2 years
mm-hmm.
with the new guys who have just come in because they're not doing what they said
because
they would
do. Haven't set their agenda, and so that race 2 years from that would be a referendum on their agenda, just like the folks who are crying about midterms about, oh, it's too much of a referendum on the president's power. Yeah, well, it is.
It is.
It's also too much of a referendum on the Congress's power every other cycle. But, Chuck, okay, just to kind of wrap this up here to kind of put the home, I'm not saying Jeff Sutton's doing anything wrong here. I think his decision, purely constitutionally, is magnificent. He closed every door
right.
of every specious argument that the homosexual rights crowd has ever put forward as to why they should have a quote-unquote right that even God doesn't recognize. He's closed the door on every possible permutation of it, and I think it's masterful. My only concern is, and I don't think even he thought about it this way, what it's done now is it's going to add voices to the momentum for calling a constitutional convention, because some of these folks probably are not big on a balanced budget amendment, but if they think that if they can get a BBA amendment process to open the door to an Article 5 convention, then they can change the Constitution to force homosexual marriage on all 50 states.
You know what, folks? I have a video that I did where I did a very short, and now I talk about an Article 5 convention. It's available from the Institute for Principled Policy. We can make it available at the smallest amount of money possible, and we'll talk about that. But and I may just say the heck with it and put it up on YouTube for free because it's that important. But we talk about that issue. And I do an analysis of the HJR 1, which I think is about to pass away, but it's a balanced budget amendment, and it does nothing. And I'm telling you, flat out nothing. And this is exactly the kind of things that they want to get a constitutional convention to get a balanced budget amendment passed, and these balanced budget amendments that are being proposed do nothing. They are full of loopholes. They're full of places where you can drive a truck through, and essentially they can borrow money till the cows come home, and it doesn't count as revenue, and so therefore it doesn't mess up the quote-unquote balanced budget. It's really just a nightmare. You need to pay attention to these kinds of things, because you know there are going to be people. You may call an Article 5 convention for the purpose of balancing the budget. And what you're going to get is a whole bunch of stuff that you do not want.
Right.
Now, don't buy into this idea that the states can control the agenda, because they can't. That we've proven that with things that are available on our website. And since we're out of time, I'm going to have to stop on that and tell you where to go to our website. It's www.principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. Look for our materials on the Article 5 Convention. It's in the left sidebar. You can find two of our publications. And we are out of time, so I'm going to have to ask you to join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.